might explode and contaminate the other eggs with bacteria.
Explode? Between mushy chick disease, exploding eggs, and culling, this project was turning out to be the worst. Then my father said,
"Look here, Juliana. You can see the embryo."
He held the flashlight and egg out so I could see. I looked inside and he said,
"See the dark spot there, in the middle, with all the veins leading to it?"
The thing that looks like a bean?
That's it.
Suddenly it felt real. This egg was alive. I quickly checked the rest of the group. There were little bean babies in all of them. Surely they had to live. Surely they would all make it. Dad, can I take the incubator inside? It might get too cold out here at night, don't you think?
I was going to suggest the same thing. Why don't you prop open the door? I'll carry it for you.
For the next 2 weeks, I was completely consumed with the growing of chicks. I labeled the eggs A, B, C, D, E, and F. But before long, they had names, too. Abby, Bonnie, Clyde, Dexter, Eunice, and Florence. Every day, I weighed them, candled them, and turned them. I even thought it might be good for them to hear some clucking, so for a while I did that, too. But clucking is tiring. It was much easier to hum around my quiet little flock, so I did that instead. Soon, I was humming without even thinking about it, because when I was around my eggs, I was happy. I read The Beginner's Guide to Raising Chickens cover to cover, twice. For my project, I drew diagrams of the various stages of an embryo's development. I made a giant chicken poster. I graphed the daily fluctuations in temperature and humidity. And I made a line chart documenting the weight loss of each egg. On the outside, eggs were boring. But I knew what was happening on the inside. Then, 2 days before the science fair, I was candling Bonnie when I noticed something. I called my dad into my room and said, "Look, Dad, look at this. Is that the heart beating?" He studied it for a moment, then smiled and said,
"Let me get your mother."
So the three of us crowded around and watched Bonnie's heartbeat. And even my mother had to admit that it was absolutely amazing. Clyde was the first to pip. And of course, he did it right before I had to leave for school. His little beak cracked through, and while I held my breath and waited, he rested. And rested. Finally, his beak poked through again, but almost right away. He rested again. How could I go to school and just leave him this way? What if he needed my help? Surely, this was a valid reason to stay home, at least for a little while. My father tried to assure me that hatching out could take all day, and that there'd be plenty of action left after school. But I'd have none of that. Oh, no, no, no. I wanted to see Abby and Bonnie and Clyde and Dexter and Eunice and Florence come into the world. Every single one of them. I can't miss the hatch, I told him. Not even a second of it.
So, take it to school with you, my mother said. Mrs. Brubeck shouldn't mind. After all, this was her idea.
Sometimes it pays to have a sensible mother. I'd just set up for the science fair early. That's what I'd do. I packed up my entire operation, posters, charts and all, and got a ride to school from my mom. Mrs. Brubeck didn't mind a bit. She was so busy helping kids with their projects that I got to spend nearly the entire day watching the hatch. Clyde and Bonnie were the first ones out. It was disappointing at first because they just lay there all wet and matted, looking exhausted and ugly. But by the time Abby and Dexter broke out, Bonnie and Clyde were fluffing up, looking for action. The last two took forever, but Mrs. Brubeck insisted that I leave them alone, and that worked out pretty great because they hatched out during the fair that night. My whole family came, and even though Matt and Mike only watched for about 2 minutes before they took off to look at some other demonstration, my mom and dad stuck around for the whole thing. Mom even picked Bonnie up and nuzzled her. That night, after it was all over, and I was packing up to go home, Mom asked,
"So do these go back to Mrs. Brubeck now?"
"Do what go back to Mrs. Brubeck?" I asked her.
"The chicks, Julie. You're not planning to raise chickens, are you?
To be honest, I hadn't thought beyond the hatch. My focus had been strictly on bringing them into the world, but she was right. Here they were. 6 fluffy little adorable chicks, each of which had a name and, I could already tell, its own unique personality. I don't know, I stammered. I'll ask Mrs. Brubeck. I tracked down Mrs. Brubeck, but I was praying that she didn't want me to give them back to her friend. After all, I'd hatched them. I'd named them. I'd saved them from mushy chick disease. These little peepers were mine. To my relief, and my mother's horror, Mrs. Brubeck said they were indeed mine. All mine. Have fun, she said, then zipped off to help Heidi dismantle her exhibit on Bernoulli's law. Mom was quiet the whole way home, and I could tell she wanted chickens like she wanted a tractor and a goat.
Please, Mom, I whispered as we parked at the curb. Please?
She covered her face.
Where are we going to raise chickens, Julie? Where?
In the backyard? I didn't know what else to suggest.
What about Champ?
They'll get along, Mom. I'll teach him, I promise.
My dad said softly,
They're pretty self-sufficient, Trina.
But then the boys piped up with,
Champ will piss them to death, Mom.
And suddenly they were on a roll.
Yeah, but you won't even notice because they're yellow already. Whoa, yellow already. Cool name. That could work.
But wait, people might think we mean our bellies.
Oh yeah, forget that. Yeah, just let them kill the chicks.
My brothers looked at each other with enormous eyes and started up all over again.
Kill the chicks! That's it, get it?
You mean like we're chick killers or like we kill the chicks?
Dad turned around and said,
Out! Both of you, get out. Go find a name elsewhere.
So they scrambled out, and the three of us sat in the car with only the gentle peep, peep, peep from my little flock breaking the silence. Finally, my mother heaved a heavy sigh and said,
They don't cost much to keep, do they?
My dad shook his head.
They eat bugs, Trina, and a little feed. They're very low maintenance.
Bugs? Really? What sort of bugs?
Earwigs, worms, roly-polies, probably spiders if they can catch them. I think they eat snails, too.
Seriously?
My mother smiled.
Well, in that case.
Oh, thank you, Mom. Thank you.
And that's how we wound up with chickens. What none of us thought of was that 6 chickens scratching for bugs not only gets rid of bugs, it also tears up grass. Within 6 months, there was nothing whatsoever left of our yard. What we also didn't think of was that chicken feed attracts mice and mice attract cats. Feral cats. Champ was pretty good at keeping the cats out of the yard, but they'd hang around the front yard or the side yard just waiting for him to snooze so they could sneak in and pounce on some tender little mousy vittles. Then my brothers started trapping the mice, which I thought was just to help out. I didn't suspect a thing until the day I heard my mother screaming from the depths of their room. They were, it turns out, raising a boa constrictor. Mom's foot came down in a big way, and I thought she was going to throw us out, lock, stock, and boa. But then I made the most amazing discovery. Chickens lay eggs. Beautiful, shiny, creamy white eggs. I first found one under Bonnie, then Clyde, whom I immediately renamed Clydette, and one more in Florence's bed.
Eggs!
I raced inside to show my mom, and after a brief moment of blinking at them, she withered into a chair.
No, she whimpered. No more chicks. They're not chicks, Mom. They're eggs.
She was still looking quite pale, so I sat in the chair next to her and said, We don't have a rooster.
Oh,
the color was coming back to her cheeks.
Is that so?
I've never heard a cock-a-doodle-doo, have you? She laughed.
A blessing, I guess I've forgotten to count.
She sat up a little and took an egg from my palm.
Eggs, huh?
How many do you suppose they'll lay?
I have no idea. As it turns out, my hens laid more eggs than we could eat. At first we tried to keep up, but soon we were tired of boiling and pickling and deviling, and my mother started complaining that all these free eggs were costing her way too much. Then one afternoon as I was collecting eggs, our neighbor, Mrs. Stubby, leaned over the side fence and said, "If you ever have any extra, I'd be happy to buy them from you."
"Really?" I asked.
"Most certainly. Nothing quite like free-range eggs. $2 a dozen sound fair to you?"
$2 a dozen?
I laughed and said, "Sure."
"Okay then, whenever you have some extras, just bring them over. Mrs. Helms and I got to discussing it last night on the phone, but I asked you first, so make sure you offer them up to me before her. Okay, Julie?"
"Sure thing, Mrs. Stubby." Between Mrs. Stubby and Mrs. Helms, three doors down, my egg overflow problem was solved. And maybe I should have turned the money over to my mother as payment for having destroyed the backyard. But one,
"Nonsense, Juliana, it's yours,"
was all it took for me to start squirreling it away. Then one day, as I was walking down to Mrs. Helms' house, Mrs. Losky drove by. She waved and smiled, and I realized with a pang of guilt that I wasn't being very neighborly about my eggs. She didn't know that Mrs. Helms and Mrs. Stubby were paying me for these eggs. She probably thought I was delivering them out of the kindness of my heart. And maybe I should have been giving the eggs away, but I'd never had a steady income before. Allowance at our house is a hit or miss sort of thing. Usually a miss. And earning money from my eggs gave me this secret happy feeling, which I was reluctant to have the kindness of my heart encroach upon. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that Mrs. Losky deserved some free eggs. She had been a good neighbor to us, lending us supplies when we ran out unexpectedly, and being late to work herself when my mother needed a ride because our car wouldn't start. A few eggs now and again, it was the least I could do. There was also the decidedly blissful possibility of running into Bryce. And in the chilly sparkle of a new day, Bryce's eyes seemed bluer than ever. The way he looked at me, the smile, the blush, it was a Bryce I didn't get to see at school. The Bryce at school was way more protected. By the third time I brought eggs over to the Loskys, I realized that Bryce was waiting for me. Waiting to pull the door open and say, "Thanks, Julie," and then, "See you at school." It was worth it. Even after Mrs. Helms and Mrs. Stubby offered me more money per dozen, it was still worth it. So through the rest of sixth grade, through all of seventh grade, and most of eighth, I delivered eggs to the Loskys. The very best, shiniest eggs went straight to the Loskys, and in return, I got a few moments alone with the world's most dazzling eyes. It was a bargain. Then, they cut down the sycamore tree. And 2 weeks later, Champ died. He'd been spending a lot of time sleeping. And even though we didn't really know how old he was, no one was really surprised when one night Dad went out to feed him and discovered he was dead. We buried him in the backyard, and my brothers put up a cross that reads, "Here lies the mystery pisser, P-I-P. I was upset and pretty dazed for a while. It was raining a lot, and I was riding my bike to school to avoid having to take the bus, and each day when I'd get home, I'd retreat to my room, lose myself in a novel, and simply forget about collecting eggs. Mrs. Stubby was the one who got me back on schedule. She called to say she'd read about the tree in the paper and was sorry about everything that had happened. But it had been some time now, and she missed her eggs and was worried that my hens might quit laying. "Distress can push a bird straight into a molting, and we wouldn't want that. Feathers everywhere and not an egg in sight. I'm quite allergic to the feathers myself, or I'd probably have a flock of my own. But never you mind. You just bring them over when you're up to it. All's I wanted was to check in and let you know how sorry I was about the tree. And your dog, too. Your mother mentioned he passed away." So I got back to work. I cleared away the eggs I'd neglected and got back into my routine of collecting and cleaning. And one morning, when I had enough, I made the rounds. First Mrs. Stubbe, then Mrs. Helms, and finally the Loskys. And as I stood at the Loskys' threshold, it occurred to me that I hadn't seen Bryce in the longest time. Sure, we'd both been at school, but I'd been so preoccupied with other things that I hadn't really seen him. My heart started beating faster, and when the door whooshed open and his blue eyes looked right at me, it took everything I had just to say, "Here." He took the half carton and said,
"You know, you don't have to give us these."
"I know," I said, and looked down. We stood there for a record-breaking amount of time, saying nothing. Finally, he said,
"So, are you going to start riding the bus again?"
I looked up at him and shrugged. "I don't know. I haven't been up there since, you know."
"It doesn't look so bad anymore. It's all cleared. They'll probably start on the foundation soon."
It sounded perfectly awful to me.
"Well," he said, "I've got to get ready for school. See you there."
Then he smiled and closed the door. For some reason, I just stood there. I felt odd, out of sorts, disconnected from everything around me. Was I ever going to go back up to Collier Street? I had to eventually, or so my mother said. Was I just making it harder? Suddenly, the door flew open, and Bryce came hurrying out with an overfull kitchen trash can in his hands.
"Julie," he said, "what are you still doing here?"
He startled me, too. I didn't know what I was still doing there, and I was so flustered that I would probably just have run home if he hadn't started struggling with the trash, trying to shove the contents down. I reached over and said, "Do you need some help?" Because it looked like he was about to spill the trash. Then I saw the corner of an egg carton. This wasn't just any egg carton, either. It was my egg carton, the one I'd just brought him. And through the little blue cardboard arcs, I could see eggs. I looked from him to the eggs and said, "What happened? Did you drop them?"
"Yeah," he said quickly. "Yeah, and I'm really sorry about that."
He tried to stop me, but I took the carton from the trash, saying, "All of them?" I opened the carton and gasped. 6 whole, perfect eggs. "Why'd you throw them away?" He pushed past me and went around the house to the trash bin, and I followed him, waiting for an answer. He shook the garbage out, then turned to face me.
"Does the word salmonella mean anything to you?"
"Salmonella, but..."
"My mom doesn't think it's worth the risk."
I followed him back to the porch. "Are you saying she won't eat them because..."
"Because she's afraid of being poisoned."
"Poisoned? Why?"
"Because your backyard is, like, covered in turds. I mean, look at your place, Julie."
He pointed at our house and said,
"Just look at it. It's a complete dive."
"It is not," I cried. But the truth was sitting right across the street, impossible to deny. My throat suddenly choked closed, and I found it painful to speak. "Have you always thrown them away?" He shrugged and looked down.
"Julie, look, we didn't want to hurt your feelings."
"My feelings? Do you realize Mrs. Stubbe and Mrs. Helms pay me for my eggs?"
"You're kidding."
"No, they pay me $2 a dozen."
"No way."
"It's true. All those eggs I gave to you, I could have sold to Mrs. Stubbe or Mrs. Helms."
"Oh,"
he said, and looked away. Then he eyed me and said,
"Well, why did you just give them to us?"
I was fighting back tears, but it was hard. I choked out, "I was trying to be neighborly." He put down the trash can, then did something that made my brain freeze. He held me by the shoulders and looked me right in the eyes.
"Mrs. Stubbe's your neighbor, isn't she? So's Mrs. Helms, right? Why be neighborly to us and not them?"
What was he trying to say? Was it still so obvious how I felt about him? And if he knew,
How could he have been so heartless, just throwing my eggs away like that, week after week, year after year? I couldn't find any words. None at all. I just stared at him, at the clear, brilliant blue of his eyes.
"I'm sorry, Julie,"
he whispered.
I stumbled home, embarrassed and confused, my heart completely cracked open.
Get a grip, man. It didn't take long for me to realize that I'd traded in my old problems with Julie Baker for a whole new set of problems with Julie Baker. I could feel her anger a mile away. It was actually worse having her mad at me than having her harass me. Why? Because I'd screwed up. That's why. I had egg all over my face, and blaming it on her yard had done nothing to wash it off. The way she ignored me, or so obviously avoided me, was a screaming, loud reminder to me that I'd been a jerk. A royal, cluck-faced jerk. Then one day, I'm coming home from hanging out with Garrett after school, and there's Julie in her front yard, hacking at a shrub. She is thrashing on the thing. Branches are flying over her shoulder, and clear across the street I can hear her grunting and growling and saying stuff like, "No, you don't. You are coming off whether you like it or not." Did I feel good about this? No, my friend, I did not. Yeah, their yard was a mess, and it was about time someone did something about it. But come on, where's the dad? What about Matt and Mike? Why Julie? Because I'd embarrassed her into it. That's why. I felt worse than ever. So I snuck inside and tried to ignore the fact that here's my desk and here's my window, and right across the street from me is Julie beating up a bush. Not conducive to concentration. No siree, Bob. I got all of zero homework done. The next day at school, I was trying to get up the nerve to say something to her, but I never even got the chance. She wouldn't let me get anywhere near her. Then, on the ride home, I had this thought. It kind of freaked me out at first, but the more I played with it, the more I figured that, yeah, helping her with the yard would make up for my having been such a jerk. Assuming she didn't boss me too much, and assuming she didn't decide to get all gooey-eyed or something stupid like that. No, I'd go up and just tell her that I felt bad for being a jerk, and I wanted to make it up to her by helping her cut back some bushes. Period. End of story. And if she still wanted to be mad at me after that, then fine. That was her problem. My problem was, I never got the chance. I came trekking down from the bus stop to find my grandfather doing my good deed. Now, jump back. This was not something I could immediately absorb. My grandfather did not do yard work. At least, he'd never offered to help me out. My grandfather lived in house slippers. Where'd he get those work boots? And those jeans and that flannel shirt, what was up with those? I crouched behind a neighbor's hedge and watched them for 10 or 15 minutes. And man, the longer I watched, the madder I got. My grandfather had already said more to her in this little slice of time than he'd said to me the whole year and a half he'd been living with us. What was his deal with Julie Baker? I took the back way home, which involved climbing two fences and kicking off the neighbor's stupid little terrier, but it was worth it, considering I avoided the garden party across the street. Again, I got no homework done. The more I watched them, the madder I got. I was still a cluck-faced jerk, while Julie was laughing it up with my grandfather. Had I ever seen him smile? Really smile? I don't think so. But now, he was knee-high in nettles, laughing. At dinner that night, he'd showered and changed back into his regular clothes and house slippers, but he didn't look the same. It was like someone had plugged him in and turned on the light. "Good evening," he said as he sat down with the rest of us.
Oh, Patsy, that looks delicious.
Well, Dad, my mom said with a laugh, your excursion across the street seems to have done you a world of good.
Yeah, my father said. Patsy tells me you've been over there all afternoon. If you were in the mood for home improvement projects, why didn't you just say so?
My father was just joking around, but I don't think my grandfather took it that way. He helped himself to a cheese-stuffed potato and said,
Pass the salt, won't you, Bryce?
So there was this definite tension between my father and my grandfather, but I think if Dad had dropped the subject right then, the vibe would have vanished. Dad didn't drop it, though. Instead, he said,
So, why's the girl the one who's finally doing something about their place?
My grandfather salted his potato very carefully, then looked across the table at me. Uh-oh, I thought. Uh-oh. In a flash, I knew those stupid eggs were not behind me. 2 years of sneaking them in the trash, 2 years of avoiding discussion of Julie and her eggs and her chickens and her early morning visits. And for what? Granddad knew. I could see it in his eyes. In a matter of seconds, he'd crack open the truth and I'd be as good as fried. Enter a miracle. My grandfather petrified me for a minute with his eyes, but then turned to my father and said,
She wants to, is all.
A raging river of sweat ran down my temples, and as my father said,
Well, it's about time someone did.
My grandfather looked back at me, and I knew he was not going to let me forget this. We'd just had another conversation, only this time I was definitely not dismissed. After the dishes were cleared, I retreated to my room, but my grandfather came right in, closed the door behind him, and then sat on my bed. He did this all without making a sound. No squeaking, no clanking, no scraping, no breathing. I swear, the guy moved through my room like a ghost. And of course, I'm banging my knee and dropping my pencil and deteriorating into a pathetic pool of jello. But I tried my best to sound cool as I said, Hello, Granddad. Come to check out the digs? He pinched his lips together and looked at nothing but me. I cracked. Look, Granddad, I know I messed up. I should have just told her, but I couldn't. And I kept thinking they'd stop. I mean, how long can a chicken lay eggs? Those things hatched in the fifth grade. That was like 3 years ago. Don't they eventually run out? And what was I supposed to do? Tell her mom was afraid of salmonella poisoning? And Dad wanted me to tell her we were allergic? Come on, who's going to buy that? So I just kept, you know, throwing them out. I didn't know she could have sold them. I thought they were just extras. He was nodding, but very slowly. I sighed and said, Thank you for not saying anything about it at dinner. I owe you. He pulled my curtain aside and looked across the street.
One's character is set at an early age, son. The choices you make now will affect you for the rest of your life.
He was quiet for a minute, then dropped the curtain and said,
I hate to see you swim out so far you can't swim back.
Yes, sir. He frowned and said,
Don't yes, sir, me, Bryce.
Then he stood and added,
Just think about what I've said. And the next time you're faced with a choice, do the right thing. It hurts everyone less in the long run.
With that, poof, he was gone. The next day I went to shoot some hoops at Garrett's after school, and when his mom dropped me off later that afternoon, my granddad didn't even notice. He was too busy being Joe Carpenter in Julie's front yard. I tried to do my homework at the breakfast bar, but my mom came home from work and started being all chatty, and then Lynetta appeared, and the two of them started fighting about whether Lynetta's makeup made her look like a wounded raccoon. Lynetta, I swear she'll never learn. I packed up my stuff and escaped to my room, which, of course, was a total waste. They've got a saw revving and wailing across the street, and in between cuts I can hear the whack, 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 whack of a hammer. I look out the window, and there's Julie, spitting out nails and slamming them in place. No kidding. She's got nails lined up between her lips like steel cigarettes, and she's swinging that hammer full arc way above her head, driving nails into pickets like they're going into butter. For a split second there, I saw my head as the recipient of her hammer, cracking open like Humpty Dumpty. I shuddered and dropped the curtain, ditched the homework, and headed for the TV. They handymanned all week, and every night, Granddad would come in with rosy cheeks and a huge appetite and compliment my mom on what a great cook she was. Then Saturday happened, and the last thing I wanted was to spend the day at home while my grandfather churned up dirt and helped plant Julie's yard. Mom tried to get me to do our own yard, but I would have felt ridiculous micro-mowing our grass with Granddad and Julie making real changes right across the street. So I locked myself in my room and called Garrett. He wasn't home, and everybody else I called had stuff they had to do. And hitting up Mom or Dad for a ride to the movies or the mall was hopeless. They'd tell me I was supposed to be doing the yard. What I was stuck. And what I wound up doing was looking out the stupid window at Julie and my grandfather. It was a totally lame thing to do. But that's what I did. I got nailed doing it, too, by my grandfather. And he, of course, had to point me out to Julie, which made me feel another 2 inches shorter. I dropped the curtain and blasted out the back door and over the fence. I had to get out of there. I swear I walked 10 miles that day, and I don't know who I was madder at, my grandfather, Julie, or me. What was wrong with me? If I wanted to make it up to Julie, why didn't I just go over there and help? What was stopping me? I wound up at Garrett's house, and man, I'd never been so glad to see anyone in my life. Leave it to Garrett to get your mind off anything important. That dude's the master. We went out back and shot hoops, watched the tube, and talked about hitting the water slides this summer. And when I got home, there was Julie, sprinkling the yard. She saw me all right, but she didn't wave or smile or anything. She just looked away. Normally, what I'd do in that situation is maybe pretend like I hadn't seen her, or give a quick wave and charge inside. But she'd been mad at me for what seemed like ages. She hadn't said word one to me since the morning of the eggs. She'd completely dissed me in math a couple days before when I'd smiled at her, trying to tell her I was sorry. She didn't smile back or nod or anything. She just turned away and never looked back. I even waited for her outside the classroom to say something, anything about her fixing up the yard and how bad I felt. But she ditched me out the other door, and after that, anytime I got anywhere near her, she'd find some way to skate around me. So there she was, watering the yard, making me feel like a jerk, and I'd had enough of it. I went up to her and said, "It's looking real good, Julie. Nice job." "Thanks," she said without smiling. "Chet did most of it." Chet? I thought. Chet? What was she doing calling my grandfather by his first name? "Look, Julie," I said, trying to get on with why I was there. "I'm sorry for what I did." She looked at me for a second, then went back to watching the water spray across the dirt. Finally, she said, "I still don't get it, Bryce. Why didn't you just tell me?" I don't know. It was dumb. I should have. And I shouldn't have said anything about the yard either. It was, you know, out of line." I was already feeling better. A lot better. Then Julie says, "Well, maybe it's all for the better," and starts bouncing up and down on the balls of her feet, acting more like her old self. Doesn't it look great? I learned so much from Chet, it's amazing. You are so lucky. I don't even have grandparents anymore. Oh, I said, not knowing what to say. I do feel sorry for him, though. He sure misses your grandmother. Then she laughs and shakes her head, saying, Can you believe it? He says I remind him of her. What? Yeah, she laughs again. That's what I said, but he meant it in a nice way. I looked at Julie and tried to picture my grandmother as an eighth grader. It was hopeless. I mean, Julie's got long, fluffy brown hair and a nose full of freckles, where my grandmother had always been some variety of blonde, and my grandmother had used powder, puffy, white powder. She'd put it on her face and in her hair, in her slippers and on her chest. That woman powdered everything. I could not see Julie coated in powder. Okay, maybe gunpowder, but the white perfumey stuff, forget it. I guess I was staring because Julie says, Look, I didn't say it. He did. I just thought it was nice, that's all. Yeah, whatever. Well, good luck with the grass. I'm sure it'll come up great. Then I totally surprised myself by saying, Knowing you, you'll get them all to hatch. I didn't say it mean or anything. I really meant it. I laughed, and then she laughed, and that's how I left her, sprinkling her soon-to-be sod, smiling. I hadn't been in such a good mood in weeks. The eggs were finally behind me. I was absolved, relieved, happy. It took me a few minutes at the dinner table to realize that I was the only one who was. Lynetta had on her usual pout, so that wasn't it. But my father's idea of saying hello was to lay into me about the lawn. No sweat, I told him. I'll do it tomorrow. All that got me was a scowl. Then Mom says to my granddad, You tired tonight, Dad? I hadn't even noticed him sitting there like a stone. Yeah, my father tosses down the table at him. That girl working you too hard? My grandfather straightens his fork on his napkin and says, That girl is named Julie, and no, she isn't working me too hard, as you so callously put it. Callous? Me? My dad laughs and says, Developed quite a soft spot for that girl, haven't you? Even Lynetta let her pout go for a minute. These were fighting words, and everyone knew it. Mom nudged Dad with her foot, but that only made things worse. No, Patsy, I want to know why your father has the energy and inclination to befriend a complete stranger when he's never done so much as toss a baseball around with his own grandson. Well, yeah, I thought. But then I remembered. I owed my grandfather. Owed him big time. Without thinking, I said, Take it easy, Dad. Julie just reminds him of Grandma. Everyone clammed up and stared at me. So I looked at my grandfather and said, Isn't that right, Granddad? He nodded and rearranged his fork some more. Of Renee? My father looked at my mother and then at Granddad. She can't possibly. My granddad closed his eyes and said, It's her spirit that reminds me of Renee. Her spirit, my father says, like he's talking to a lying kindergartner. Yes, her spirit. My grandfather's quiet for a minute, then asks, Do you know why the Bakers haven't fixed up the yard until now? Why, sure. They're trash, that's why. They've got a beat-up house, two beat-up cars, and a beat-up yard. They are not trash, Rick. They are good, honest, hard-working people who have absolutely no pride in how they present themselves to the rest of the world. We lived across the street from those people for over 6 years, and there is no excuse for the state they're in. No. My grandfather takes a deep breath and seems to weigh things in his mind for a few seconds. Then he says, Tell me this, Rick. If you had a brother or sister or child who had a severe mental or physical handicap, What would you do? It was like my granddad had passed gas in church. My father's face pinched. His head shook. And finally he said, "Chet, what does that have to do with anything?" My grandfather looks at him for a minute, then quietly says, "Julie's father has a retarded brother." And my father interrupts him with a laugh. "Well, that explains a lot, doesn't it?" "Explains a lot?" my grandfather asks, quietly, calmly. "Sure, it explains why those people are the way they are." He grins around the table at us. "Must run in the family." Everyone looks at him. Lynetta's jaw drops. And for once, she's speechless. My mother says, "Rick!" But all my father can do is laugh a nervous kind of laugh and say, "It was just a joke. I mean, obviously something's wrong with those people. Oh, excuse me, Chet, I forgot. The girl reminds you of Renee." "Rick!" my mother says again. Only this time, she's mad. "Oh, Patsy, please. Your father's being overly dramatic, trying to make me feel bad for criticizing our neighbors because there's a retarded relative someplace. Other people have family troubles and still manage to mow their lawn. They should have a little pride and ownership for crying out loud." My grandfather's cheeks are seriously flushed, but his voice is rock steady as he says, "They don't own that house, Rick. The landlord is supposed to maintain the premises, but he doesn't. And since Julie's father is responsible for his brother, all their reserves go to his care. And obviously, it doesn't come cheap." Very quietly, my mom asks, "Don't they have government facilities for that kind of thing?" "I don't know the details, Patsy. Maybe there are no government facilities nearby. Maybe they thought a private facility was a better place for him to be." "Still," my dad says, "there are government facilities available, and if they don't want to go that route, that's their choice. It's not our fault their family had some sort of chromosomal abnormality, and I refuse to feel guilty for wanting..." My grandfather slams his hand on the table and half stands as he says, "It had nothing to do with chromosomes, Rick. It was caused by a lack of oxygen at birth." He brings his voice down, but it makes his words seem even more forceful. "Julie's uncle had the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck. Twice. One minute, he was a perfect little baby, just like your son Bryce. And the next, he was irreversibly damaged." My mother was suddenly hysterical. In seconds, she was bawling her eyes out, wailing, and my father was all over her, trying to calm her down. It was no use. She basically dissolved, right there on the spot. Lynetta threw her napkin down and muttered, "This family is a joke," and took off. Then my mother bolted out of the room, sobbing into her hands, and my father raced after her, throwing my grandfather the wickedest look I'd ever seen. That left Granddad and me and a table full of cold food. "Wow," I finally said. "I had no idea."
"You still don't," he told me.
"What do you mean?"
He sat there like granite for a minute, then leaned across the table toward me and said, "Why do you suppose that upsets your mother so much?"
I don't know.
I gave a half-hearted grin and said, "Because she's female?" He smiled, but just barely. "No. She's upset because she knows that she could very well be standing in Mr. Baker's shoes right now." I thought about it a minute and finally asked, "Did her brother have the cord around his neck when he was born?" He shook his head. "Well then," he leaned forward even farther and whispered, "you did."
"I did?" He nodded. Twice. But the doctor who delivered you was on the ball. Plus, apparently, there was some slack in the cord, so he was able to loop it off as you came out. You didn't hang yourself coming into the world, but it could very easily have gone the other way. If I'd been told years or even weeks ago that I'd come down the chute noosed and ready to hang, I'd have made some kind of joke about it. Or more likely, I'd have said, "Yeah, that's nice. Now, can you spare me the discussion?" But after everything that had happened, I was really freaking out, and I couldn't escape the questions tidal-waving my brain. Where would I be if things had been different? What would they have done with me? From the way my dad was talking, he wouldn't have had much use for me, that's for sure. He'd have stuck me in a nut house somewhere, anywhere, and forgotten about me. But then I thought, no, I'm his kid. He wouldn't do that. Would he? I looked around at everything we had. The big house, the white carpet, the antiques and artwork and stuff that was everywhere. Would they have given up all the stuff to make my life more pleasant? I doubted it. And man, I doubted it big time. I'd have been an embarrassment, something to try to forget about. How things looked had always been a biggie to my parents, especially to my dad. Very quietly, my granddad said, "You can't dwell on what might have been, Bryce." Then, like he could read my mind, he added, "And it's not fair to condemn him for something he hasn't done." I nodded and tried to get a grip, but I wasn't doing a very good job of it. Then he said, "By the way, I appreciated your comment before." "What?" I asked, but my throat was feeling all pinched and swollen. "About your grandmother. How did you know that?" I shook my head and said, "Julie told me."
"Oh? You spoke with her then?"
"Yeah. Actually, I apologized to her."
"Well."
And I was feeling a lot better about everything, but now... God, I feel like such a jerk again.
"Don't. You apologize, and that's what matters."
He stood up and said,
"Say, I'm in the mood for a walk. Want to join me?"
Go for a walk? What I wanted to do was go to my room, lock the door, and be left alone. "I find it really helps to clear the mind," he said. And that's when I realized that this wasn't just a walk. This was an invitation to do something together. I stood up and said, "Yeah, let's get out of here." For a guy who'd only basically ever said "pass the salt" to me, my granddad turned out to be a real talker. We walked our neighborhood and the next neighborhood and the next neighborhood, and not only did I find out that my granddad knows a lot of stuff, I found out that the guy is funny, in a subtle kind of dry way. It's the stuff he says, plus the way he says it. It's really, I don't know, cool. As we were winding back into our own territory, we passed by the house that's going up where the sycamore tree used to be. My granddad stopped, looked up into the night, and said, "It must have been a spectacular view." I looked up too, and noticed for the first time that night that you could see the stars. "Did you ever see her up there?" I asked him. "Your mother pointed her out to me one time as we drove by. It scared me to see her up so high, but after I read the article, I understood why she did it." He shook his head. "The tree's gone, but she's still got the spark it gave her. Know what I mean?" Luckily, I didn't have to answer. He just grinned and said, "Some of us get dipped in flat, some in satin, some in gloss." He turned to me. "But every once in a while, you find someone who's iridescent. And when you do, nothing will ever compare." As we walked up to our front porch, my grandfather put his arm around my shoulder and said, "It was nice walking with you, Bryce. I enjoyed myself very much." "Me too," I told him, and we went inside. Right away we knew we'd stepped into a war zone, and even though no one was yelling or crying, from the look on my parents' faces I could tell there'd been a major meltdown while my granddad and I were out. Granddad whispered to me, "I've got another fence to mend, I'm afraid," and headed into the dining room to talk to my parents. I wanted nothing to do with that vibe. I went straight to my room, closed the door, and flopped through the darkness onto my bed. I lay there a while and let the dinner disaster play through my mind. And when I'd totally burned a fuse thinking about it, I sat up and looked out the window. There was a light on somewhere inside the baker's house, and the streetlights were glowing. But the night still seemed really dense, like it was darker than usual, and, I don't know, heavy. I leaned closer to the window and looked up into the sky, but I couldn't see the stars anymore. I wondered if Julie had ever been in the sycamore at night, among the stars. I shook my head. Flat, glossy, iridescent. What was up with that? Julie Baker had always seemed just plain dusty to me. I snapped on my desk lamp and dug the newspaper with the article about Julie out of the drawer where I'd tossed it. Just like I thought, they made it sound like Julie was trying to save Mount Rushmore or something. They called her a strong voice in an urban wilderness and a radiant beacon shedding light on the need to curtail continued overdevelopment of our once quaint and tranquil community. Spare me. I mean, what's wrong with letting a guy cut down a tree on his own property so he can build a house? His lot, his tree, his decision. End of story. The piece in the paper was Gag Me Gush. Except. Except for the places where they quoted Julie. Maybe it was just in contrast to the reporter's slant or something. But Julie's parts didn't come off, "Oh, woe is me," like I was expecting. They were, I don't know, deep. Sitting in that tree was seriously philosophical to her. And the odd thing is, it all made sense to me. She talked about what it felt like to be up in that tree and how it, like, transcended dimensional space. "To be held above the earth and brushed by the wind," she said. "It's like your heart has been kissed by beauty." Who in junior high do you know that would put together a sentence like that? None of my friends, that's for sure. There was other stuff, too. Like how something can be so much more than the parts it took to make it. And why people need things around them that lift them above their lives and make them feel the miracle of living. I wound up reading and rereading her parts, wondering when in the world she started thinking like that. I mean, no kidding. Julie Baker's smart, but this was something way beyond straight A's. A month ago, if I'd read this article, I would have chucked it in the trash as complete garbage. But for some reason, it made sense to me now. A lot of sense. A month ago, I also wouldn't have paid any attention to the picture of Julie, but now I found myself staring at it. Not the one of the whole scene, that was more emergency rescue equipment than Julie. The other one, on the bottom half of the page. Someone must have used a killer telephoto lens, because you can tell that she's in the tree, but it's mostly from the shoulders up. She's looking off into the distance, and the wind is blowing her hair back, like she's at the helm of a ship or something, sailing into the sun. I'd spent so many years avoiding Julie Baker that I'd never really looked at her. And now all of a sudden, I couldn't stop. This weird feeling started taking over the pit of my stomach, and I didn't like it, not one bit. To tell you the truth, it scared the sheetrock out of me. I buried the paper under my pillow and tried to remind myself of what a pain Julie Baker was. but my mind started to wander again. And pretty soon, I had that stupid paper out from under my pillow. This was insane. What was I doing? I made myself shut out the light and go to bed. I was slipping, man, and it was definitely time to get a grip.
The yard. I'd never been embarrassed by where we lived before. I'd never looked at our house or even our side of the street and said, "Oh, I wish we lived in the new development. Those houses are so much newer, so much better." This is where I'd grown up. This was my home. I was aware of the yard, sure. My mother had grumbled about it for years. But it was a low grumbling, not worthy of deep concern. Or so I'd supposed. But maybe I should have wondered. Why let the outside go and keep the inside so nice? It was spotless inside our house. Except for the boys' room, that is. Mom gave up on that after she discovered the snake. If they were old enough to adopt a snake, she told my brothers, they were old enough to clean their own room. Matt and Mike translated this to keep the door closed, and became quite diligent about doing just that. Besides the yard, I also never really wondered about the money, or the apparent lack thereof. I knew we weren't rich, but I didn't feel like I was missing anything. Anything you could buy, anyway. Matt and Mike did ask for things a lot, but even though my mother would tell them, "No, boys, we just can't afford that," I took this to mean, "No, boys, you don't deserve that," or, "No, boys, you don't really need that." It wasn't until Bryce called our home a complete dive that I started really seeing things. It wasn't just the yard. It was my dad's truck, my mother's car, the family bike that was more rust than steel, and the fact that when we did buy something new, it always seemed to come from a second-time-around store. Plus, we never went on vacation. Ever. Why was that? My father was the hardest-working man in the world, and my mother worked for temp service doing secretarial jobs whenever she could. What was all that hard work about if this is where it got you? Asking my parents whether we were poor seemed incredibly impolite. But as the days went by, I knew I had to ask. Just had to. Every day I'd ride home from school on our rusty bike, pull past the broken fence and patchy yard and think, "Tonight. I'll ask them tonight." But then I wouldn't ask them. I just didn't know how. Then one day I had an idea. A way to talk to them about it and maybe help out a little too. And since my brothers were working at the music store that night, and nobody was saying much of anything at the table, I took a deep breath and said, "I was thinking, you know, that it wouldn't be hard to fix up the front yard if I could get some nails and a hammer and maybe some paint. And how much does grass seed cost? It can't be that much, right? I could plant a lawn and maybe even some flowers." My parents stopped eating and stared at me. "I know how to use a saw and a hammer. It could be, you know, a project." My mother quit looking at me and stared at my father instead. My father sighed and said, "The yard is not our responsibility, Juliana."
It's not?
He shook his head and said,
"It's Mr. Finnegan's."
"Who's Mr. Finnegan?"
"The man who owns this house."
I couldn't believe my ears. "What?" My father cleared his throat and said,
"The landlord."
"You mean we don't own this house?" They looked at each other, having some private, wordless conversation I couldn't decipher. Finally, my father said,
"I didn't realize you didn't know that."
But that doesn't make sense. Aren't landlords supposed to come and do things? Like fix the roof when it leaks and clear the drains when they're plugged? You always do that stuff, Dad. Why do you do it when he's supposed to?
"Because,"
he sighed,
"it's easier than asking him for help."
"But if..."
"And,"
my father interrupted me,
"it keeps him from raising the rent."
"But..." My mother reached over and took my hand. "Sweetheart, I'm sorry if this is a shock. I guess we always thought you knew. But what about the yard? why keep up the inside but not the outside? My father frowned and said,
When we signed the lease, he assured us he would fix the fences, front and back, and plant sod in the front yard. Obviously, that never happened.
He shook his head.
It's a major undertaking, and fencing is not cheap. I can't see putting that sort of investment into